Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. So look, we have a kind of an extraordinary situation going on this weekend whereby this 40-year-old case has blown back up, but it is all playing out very publicly, the investigation into it. So there's a lot about the ongoing investigation in the papers there. I'll read you some of the front pages. The Sunday Independent is quoting Padraig O'Connell, the solicitor for the couple who were questioned, saying all Gardaí wanted was an admission of murder. Solicitor for couple in Kerry Babies probe said they were subject to intense interrogation. The Mail on Sunday, DNA of the quotes Kerry baby parents taken from bin. The Business Post then is gone with what could be a story that could be a much bigger story in a few weeks. ECB warned that shadow banking could trigger next financial crisis. And there is a kind of a guessing game going on internationally as to which black box that we don't know what's in it is going to be the next black swan that causes the international financial crisis. There seems to be a lot of people are talking about a credit crunch on the way. Commercial property is one thing that's being fingered as a potential that could blow up in all our faces. So anyway, this Sunday Mirror, Air Force One. So Gardaí have been told no further leave or rest days will be granted during the week beginning April 10th, which means that people are thinking that that's when Joe Biden comes. And the Sun on Sunday, Get Mac. Tubbs wants Beatles legend as guest on last show. RTÉ bosses are determined to book Paul McCartney as Ryan Tubridy's dream last guest, the Sun can reveal. Okay. Our panel today, Christina Finn, is a political correspondent at thejournal.ie. Ciarán Macaverd is Associate Professor of Business and Management at DCU. Tom Parlin is the Director General of the Construction Industry Federation. And Minnie Mooney is a student and a Gen Z commentator. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
And put on your headphones there, because we are also joined now by Anne Lucy, who is a journalist in Kerry. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Brendan.
And you're down in Killarney at the moment, I think. Like, how is this playing out in Kerry? What's the feeling over the last 2 days?
There is an overwhelming feeling of, 40 years ago, to be quite frank, Brendan. And people are talking, obviously, everybody is, but very discreetly. I was in shops in Killarney and various places yesterday and in Tralee. And people are not talking openly. It's discreet, but, all women particularly are speaking about this to each other, and they're speaking in terms of the overwhelming social context of the time, Brendan, really. There's a lot of questioning about what will this achieve, even if they get somebody at this stage. There's nobody out in Kerry sort of shouting to find the person who, or persons or whatever, who did this. That's certainly the case. And there's a lot of memories, I suppose, being dragged up for women of my age and even younger. And they're saying that, the time was so different, Brendan, then. 1984 was... I think it was almost the peak of misogyny, and we didn't use that word then. I don't think we even used the word anti-woman then. It was just accepted that you had few rights in the society. You had, I've been trying to communicate it and I'm trying to explain it, but... But the best scenario I can give, you had that divisive referendum in September 1983 where you inserted into the Constitution that the life of the unborn was equal to the life of the mother. And you had a bitter debate prior to that. And it lingered, Brendan. April 84, you had January 84 as well with Anne Lovett, and you had a series of... of absolute fear of women, by women too. Like, friends of mine were saying yesterday, like, the last thing you'd have done was go home and say you were pregnant. A, you'd probably be given the door. And it was just, sex was a crime, Brendan. Sex, we have sexual crime now, I was saying, you know, but then, for that period particularly, sex outside marriage was a crime. It was the crime. It was, it was, and you had no contraception in Kerry, and if you were married, you could pretend maybe to be married, but everybody knew everyone, and you could go to the doctor, but then you would be asked, has your husband given permission to go on the pill if you were a young female, 20-something. And remember, people were getting more educated. Women were more educated. You had high numbers for the first time doing leaving certs and things from the late 70s onwards. You had people going to university as well. But you didn't have family planning clinics. You had no structure like that. What you did was you went to Cork. There was the Cork Family Planning Clinic, for instance. But yeah, that was the context of the time that I...
Alva Smith echoed a lot of what you're saying with us yesterday did. And spoke very eloquently about the context of the time. And I suppose that context notwithstanding, is there not a feeling here, regardless of the general atmosphere in the country or an atmosphere of misogyny or call it what you will, that there was a great injustice done here, that a lot of guards and the people involved in this behaved very badly, and now the guards seem to, some of the guards involved in this want to get justice for that baby and want to see the truth come out.
Well, you see, that is what people are saying. They're saying that, who is this serving? Who will it best serve? It will certainly not best serve... You probably, I don't know the details of that, I don't want to go into the personal details, but it doesn't matter who it is. It's 40 years ago. The only people are saying to me that the people this best serves are the Gardaí themselves, insofar as they'll have probably resolved a crime. There are a lot of crimes that are unresolved.
And that's what we want the guards to do, isn't it?
Yeah, but they're also saying that there is no crying out for justice. Yes, it is terrible what happened, and justice shall be done, but and will be done, and it is always desirable. But this particular case, there is no outcry from any community that I know of in Kerry for this to be resolved. People
you see, is that part of it,
morning.
Though, Anne? Is it part
Pardon?
Of it that is it part of it that there is that there was no outcry, that there was a lot unsaid? I know this is very painful, right? But was there a lot unsaid down there for 40 years?
In terms of the guards?
In terms of the people down there now who are saying, why can't this be left alone? It was left alone in a way, wasn't it, for 40 years too, like, and the people left things unsaid down there.
But they did leave things unsaid, but because the guards acted so brutally at the time that the focus shifted on the... It's like the focus shifting on the journalist who tells the story. You want the focus to be on the story, but in this case, the focus was on the Gardaí, the inquirers into the story. And it the focus was relentless, really, because of the tribunal, which took place very quickly, actually, when you look at how long tribunals take today. But it took place in 1985 in Tralee, and it was the coverage was huge. And so, you know, the focus has been on the Gardaí themselves, not on the crime.
And in terms of the focus is back on the crime now, Padraig O'Connell, the Killarney solicitor who's representing this man and woman who were released without charge, has been out talking a lot about this as well. And he has issues in relation to how this is being covered in the media, doesn't he?
Well, he does. does, because whilst the people who have actually who've been released without charge, it's important to say, Brendan, and whilst they were in custody in Kerry on Friday, there was wall-to-wall discussion, and you know there was a lot of interest, and you had the senior guards of the night before coming out and saying this is a significant move, and you had a lot of, you had really a lot of discussion on the airway about DNA and whatnot, and he did, he expressed a lot of concern about how, you know, he said this is considered, he said there's nothing, there's absolutely no justification in the context of due process. So he raised questions about how was this fair. And he also asked specifically, he said, has anyone learned from the previous incarnation of this tragic event? Now, subsequently, he voiced concern about the fact that you had a large media presence outside Castle Island Station when the woman was being released without charge. And he's said, you know, he's raising concerns. He's going to write to the Minister for Justice about how can somebody who's not been charged with an offence be met with cameras and flash bulbs, as he put it. So he's been speaking out in that context.
Yeah, and people might have heard him on Saturday with Colm O'Mongan on yesterday. He's in the papers today, and he is adamant that there isn't a scintilla of evidence and that these people are entirely innocent of murder. Anne, will you stay with us?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I just want to bring in the panel. Minnie Mooney, is this all another country to someone your age? What do you make of it all?
I think, I think putting it in terms of is it another country actually is not far off the truth. I mean, as a young woman, it's crazy to hear about it. Like, we're often told, or I certainly was growing up, oh, you know, Ireland in the 80s was so different. It was such a different time, such a different place. But then you actually hear this kind of story and it adds so much more weight to that. It kind of puts things into perspective. Like, that kind of stuff, I mean, you would hope wouldn't happen now.
Did you know girls who got pregnant?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, Anne just said there, you know, you were given the door and it was the kind of height of crime was to have sex outside marriage. Now it's basically a given that you're having sex outside marriage. It's not the case for everyone, but for most people my generation.
Yeah. And it was stigma around if a girl got pregnant in school or in college or young or whatever. Is that stigma gone?
I wouldn't say it's gone. It's definitely not there to the same extent. I think for older women, even in the kind of older half of my generation, to, you know, have sex or you know, become pregnant outside of marriage, it's the kind of outside of marriage thing doesn't have the same sort of stigma that it used
to. Yeah, I was even thinking yesterday, I think Ava Smith referred to the idea of an unmarried mother, or a mother, as you would probably call it now, but that there was this category, an unmarried mother. Yeah. Christina, you've been looking across the coverage here, the front pages of the Mail on Sunday, the Sunday Indo, the Sunday Times. So what jumped out for you?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, a case that's so old is actually, you know, the impact of it and the, you know, what it meant and still means for Irish society is on the front pages. And I think Gene Kerrigan actually summed it up quite well in his headline, saying we're still cleaning up a 39-year-old mess. And he goes very much into, as we were speaking about the 1980s Ireland, saying secret babies and silent burials were one marker of that strange old Ireland. And, you know, I think speaking to, you know, I was born in 1984, so I would have come up knowing this story, but always in the background of it. But I think it speaks true, really, to the Ireland that it was. And once you're speaking, you know, about the progressions that we've made through Irish society, I know myself, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, yes, obviously sex before marriage was still a stigma as such, and that the unmarried mother title that people were given. I would have known girls in my teenage years who would have become pregnant. And I think there was a lot more openness about it. There was, you know, I know schools were a lot more open to facilitating young girls who had become pregnant, be it with giving them a locker in school. I remember one girl, they didn't have lockers for every student in the school, yeah, but she was facilitated with one. So that it was a lot more open and a lot more, you know, acceptable, I think. And when you look back at some of the stories from the 1980s, particularly this horrific case, it really does speak true to, I suppose, how far we have come, thankfully, in Ireland, to be able to, I suppose, be more open, less judgmental. But I would still say we do have a long way to go in a lot of those regards. But
because it can be very tempting, Ciarán, to sit here patting ourselves on the back for how far we've come and those terrible dark chapters. But as I remember the 80s, we were patting ourselves on the back then as well for how far we'd come.
You are right, Brendan, and we have come a long way, but the element of this that's very, very distressing is for the people involved. It's very distressing for Joanna Hayes and her family, for example, to go into a news agent's or a filling station forecourt today and see it again plastered all over the media. Anne was saying there, she used the phrase, what cause is served? What cause is served? Plastering this story again all over the media. I mean, you dealt with it very, very sensitively yesterday on your programme. But, and you said there's a lot left unsaid. There's far too much coverage in the media. Anne said there was a large media presence.
There were flashbulbs. I suppose it's an iconic case in terms of the meaning of this country and who we are and everything else and all kinds of echoes and shadows and everything else. It's a primal kind of wound almost in this country that opens up now and again, maybe.
Very true. But as you say, it's a very, very different country. I mean, most people in this country at the moment reading the media and listening today weren't born in, they don't have an idea of the context. And whereas you're reading it, you get some idea, but you need to have lived through it to realise the full context. And in the reporting, I don't think newspaper editors take full... There's not enough empathy for the people who were so badly affected, badly treated. I mean, I remember Paula Meehan and her writing a poem about the Anne Lovett case. She didn't publish the poem until many years later, and she posed the question, do I as an artist have a right to intrude on a grieving family to create my art? Do I have a right to invade a grieving community to create my art? And I wish, covering the case, that we're more sensitive to the people involved, because very distressing.
We'll say in defence of the media that I think there is very much a vindication of Joanne Hayes and her family. There is very much that outrage again at what was done to them, which everyone agrees now was absolutely appalling travesty. Tom Parlin, where were you at in your life in 1984? Were you involved in politics at that stage?
No? Not at all. I was just thinking, I remember 1984 as the year that Cork beat Offaly in the centenary All-Ireland hurling final. That was a big deal.
That was in Thurles, was that 84? Yeah, God, I remember.
But I'm just
thinking
in terms of that famous, baby John would have been the same age as Christina now. And God knows what potential he would have had, in terms of growing. So that was a very, very sad affair. But you said yourself about things being unsaid. At the time, in the country and not in the cities as well, such issues were sort of buried. The pregnant girl was sent away. Nobody spoke about it. That's just what happened. But I think really the flawed investigation, and at the time as well in 84, we were dealing with subversives. The state was under attack here. I'd say the Gardaí, no different than now, were under-resourced. They had a heavy squad, which decided new tactic if you were trying to deal with subversives that were attacking Gardaí and blowing up people and murdering and so on. They wouldn't speak, so you used fairly heavy tactics to get them to confess.
So it's funny, it's yet another way in which the so-called Troubles warped the instruments of the state, really, and the apparatus of the state.
Clearly,
you're saying that the guards were twisted by this.
This big story blew up. There was a group sent down to Kerry to investigate it. They wanted to get a result. Circumstances seemed to lead in a particular direction. They got full confessions out of four members of the Hayes family that were entirely innocent, which is still extraordinary, and regardless of the tribunal or whatever. So, I don't know why it's up again. I don't think it does anybody any good. I think it just brings back a lot of sadness. There's no winners. But there may be, and I don't know, a reason that the guards are still trying to vindicate the mess they made of the situation at the time.
But at the same time, this is a newsworthy story because, you know, it's honing in on the issue of the guards having this new, their cold case unit opening up all these cases of the past that, like, we can't forget. It's unsolved. Do you know what I mean? Like, justice has not been done.
And I think as well, much as women were wronged and people were wronged by the guards in this case, and women were wronged in the country in general, this was a very, very brutal murder, Christina, wasn't it? We don't need to get into the details of it, but it was a brutal crime.
Yeah, absolutely horrific. And, you know, as much as we're saying, like, this was a wound that was left open and should we go back there? Like, this is a crime. Like, the guards have a job to do. This is why that cold case unit was set up in the first place, to go back over all these cases. And we don't need to rehash, I suppose, the botched job of the investigation at the time. And, you know, some of the reporting from the inquiry has been described as farcical today in the newspapers. You know, but like, we're talking about a case that was reopened in 2018. DNA evidence has come to the fore of that from 2021. You know, a trawling of, you know, involuntary DNA samples being taken from people down there. So this is an investigation that is worthy of being carried out at the end of it. Look, there's no winners here at the end of it, but it is an unsolved question that I think we really do have to put to bed at this stage.
And I got the impression from the few people I spoke to in Kerry in the last 24 hours that people are very angry with the media down there, are they?
I don't think so. I don't think they're angry with the media. I mean, you
cranky. What you said? Cranky with the media.
I think that I don't think they are. I mean, I'm not getting a sense that people are giving out to me or to anybody else. Like, one thing that has to be realised is that 2018, the reopening of this inquiry, and I was there in Cathair Sévigne in January. Yeah. This was a huge Garda-led event. There was a press conference. There's statements out on the arrest of two people on Thursday night, late on Thursday night, by the Gardaí, calling it significant. So this is a Garda-led event.
I suppose, like, that's the guard's job as well, is to.
But I'm talking about the focus. The focus is there because of the legitimate inquiry by the Gardaí into this event. And what it is doing is inadvertently, perhaps, it's putting that whole era on trial. And I think the focus in that respect is most justified. Like, I was listening to the language even of your contributors there, and, you know, they were talking about the time the troubles were on. Yeah, it was hugely... it was the guard attitude at the time. It was during the Troubles. But a woman who was pregnant was said to be in trouble, was the phrase. And don't forget, like, that a baby born outside of wedlock was illegitimate, Brendan. Yeah. It was only 1987 when that was changed. So you had legitimate and illegitimate children, which sounds extraordinary now.
Yeah.
So I think
notwithstanding what Tom Parlin said, and that is, again, that's another background to all of this. Let us not let it go unsaid that the behaviour of a lot of the guards around this was absolutely appalling, and there was no excuse for it.
Absolutely no excuse. And it still lingers. Listen, March in Kerry is the 100th anniversary of a very bitter civil war. And I've been to several events where you had testimonies and talk. It was this, as if it were yesterday. And there is this extraordinary thing in Kerry, Brendan, more so than anywhere else. History is like an hour ago, even if it's 100 years ago. And It is. And it's so, I mean, we became emotional about things that happened 100 years ago. You had something like 5 different ceremonies in Ballyseedy because no two sides could agree to hold the thing together.
Okay.
That context.
Kerry
too.
Journalist Anne Lucy, thank you very much. And our panel, Christina Finn, Ciarán MacInverd, excuse me, Tom Parlin and Minnie Mooney staying with us. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
An emailer said it wasn't the Troubles that was responsible for the crimes women and girls were subjected to. It was the collusion between church and state from the early years of the state that was responsible. I don't think anyone was suggesting that. I think Tom was making a fairly valid point about the culture in the police force then was shaped by guys who had spent too much time up near the border and too much time involved in that kind of stuff. Now, just to remind you, our panel is Christina Finn, Ciarán MacInvert, Tom Parlin and Minnie Mooney. We move on to housing. Tom, before we get into the papers, like, there's no big bang answer at this stage or anything, but like, as the head of the Construction Industry Federation, do you have any answer here to where we're at with housing?
Well, we had our house builders had their annual conference last week in Croke Park. Dara O'Brien spoke to it by video. He was busy dealing with the fallout in the Dáil from the eviction ban and so on. And generally, like, it was talking to the converted. We had the house builders and all of the professionals and some external. Clearly, we need to build a lot more houses. Last year, we built 30,000 houses, which was substantially more than was expected. But we're falling short. And the general consensus is we need to build between 40 and 50,000. And that's probably a deficit of about 250,000, which is nearly a doubling of the housing stock. So there needs to be a massive increase. The big factor is delays in our own system. Like, we've had war and we have supply chain issues and we have inflation that's outside our own control. But it's the planning, the zoning.
There's 70,000 planning permissions at the moment that aren't being built, aren't there?
Well, there's 70,000 as well that are held up in Bord Pleanála. Like,
could we not build the ones that are done by blaming the 70,000 that are held up in planning?
Well, unfortunately, the ones, like, we have strict rules about density, and very often if you're building 100 houses, you have to get a very tight density. And in the country and outside Dublin, and even in Dublin, it means building either duplexes or apartments. Apartments are totally unviable.
Not viable.
They're just, like, and that makes the whole project unviable.
And our houses, more viable?
Well, clearly changing the density, but one of the figures, like, it takes...
But if they're not viable, let me ask you some simple layman's questions. If houses aren't viable, when they're completely unaffordable for the vast majority of young people, then they're never going to be viable, are they? Because what we need for people to be able to afford them is for them to get cheaper. And if they're not viable at the moment, well then, like, are we stuck in a catch 22 here where there's paralysis, like?
Well, I was at a FIEC, or European Construction Organization, during the week.
Yeah.
And they have the very same problems right across Europe now. Like, inflation is added massively to the cost. But I'll just give you one figure. In terms of the time it takes here to complete a scheme of houses, from the time you decide I'm going to do this, make the planning application, acquire the land, all of that, it's 5 to 6 years. But the actual building of the house, as soon as the site is prepared, from 22 to 26 weeks with a new timber frame house, which is generally what builders are bringing, to put it down, to put a brick outer layer around it, to put on the roof.
So an element of prefabrication, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the way to go.
Because I think a lot of people wonder as well, Tom, why are we building houses more or less the same way houses were built 100 years ago when the rest of the world has completely changed?
How
we have done everything has been completely disrupted.
Yeah, the fact is, Brendan, that we're not actually doing it. We are doing it. And modern methods of construction is the global term for using new methods.
Are they happening? Are they coming on stream?
Like, currently, the government decided to build 750 modular homes for the Ukrainians. The problem is everywhere they go to cite them, there are, despite the fact that the OPW has very powerful legislation and says, look, we can put these here, we have an emergency, we must deal with it. Locals have been objecting, workers have been assaulted on site. It's the public are not allowing the situation. And of course,
Modular homes, are they cost effective and is that a viable strategy?
I'd say they're equally expensive as.
Are they?
But I suppose we have a hybrid. What's called a timber frame home. So in a number of factories around, they make the actual timber frame, the walls, the partitions, the roofs and so on. They bring them and they put them up with a truck and a crane like a Lego. And then obviously for our Irish climate here, it's so damp and so on, the timber has to be surrounded by a brick or a stone exterior.
And that'll last as long as, because there's some modular homes are 30, home. Some are 60, so that's regular, yeah.
The modular is built entirely in a plant. It's generally a steel frame. Yeah, and so on. So it's but they're very good.
Are we making them in Ireland?
We are making them now. Like obviously,
what's the capacity of the industry in Ireland for modular homes? Do you think?
Well, the difficulty, our procurement system is quite different. If you're making modular homes, so you supply the entire home on a number of trucks and you put it down, and hey presto, you've got a full house. So you need to get paid for that before it leaves the plant, or even before you start acquiring all of the materials. Our procurement system hasn't adopted itself to deal with that. So it makes the funding of those very difficult. For the Ukrainians, where the government are funding, that is easier. But okay. So we have a lot
You would say a lot of sclerosis in the system.
Yeah, but I would say the capacity to do 40,000 to 50,000 houses at the moment within the industry.
You do, and you have the workers to do that.
There are challenges about workers, but we have the capacity to do it.
But they're not viable, no?
Well, we can't build apartments at the moment. Now, the Taoiseach had a special summit in government buildings looking at how we can increase. There were a lot of suggestions from the whole lot of stakeholders. I was there myself.
Useful suggestion you heard?
Well, one was obviously inflation has caught on and has impacted. But whether it be local authorities or housing agencies or the Department of Housing, they're still expecting to get a house for about 50,000 less than the builder can provide it. Now, that's an unfortunate fact of life. They're costing that. They're not going to come back in the short term. Inflation and the level it's got, you know, is there, and there's going to be continued demand. So they're trying to find their way up to that system. But there's a bit of a bias always, I feel, against builders or developers in terms of allowing them the full amount of money that they require. There's always the old-fashioned stuff about, we'll offer them 10% or 5% less and we'll try and squeeze a deal out of them. That's not going to work at the moment. You can't begin a house unless it's going to be viable.
So if we're in a situation now whereby a developer needs 50,000 extra for a house over what the price is now, when property, and I'm sorry, I'm being repetitive here, but when property prices are off the charts, most people would agree, then we're stuck, are we?
Well, obviously, the government have quite a strong balance sheet at the moment. We're spending about 4 billion on housing. But if we're to build 50,000 houses, it's multiples of that.
Do you know what I'd say to you, though? I would say in any other industry, right, if there were very high market prices there, and if the industry was turning around and saying, well, we can't do it for those prices, someone else would come in that industry who could do it for those prices. There'd be efficiencies in the industry. Businesses figure out how to make a product and bring it to market to a point that it meets customer demand and meets a customer price point.
Yeah, and I'd say that's what the industry are striving to do at the moment. But inflation has been a new factor, like in terms of increasing costs by timber or steel by 40 and 50%. But on the other hand, we have standards set here. And I don't think in any debate we could have an argument and say, the standards are too high, they're too expensive. But they are the most expensive and the highest standards in the world.
Yeah,
and
but you see, this is back to dark chapters as well. We've been burned in the past by standards.
You might
standards,
want to go back
yeah.
that far, but we could find a place in between.
Yeah,
we could
build
a cheaper house that would accommodate families.
So standards, fix the planning, the kind of general system. Systemic sclerosis and everything, but still kind of no real answer at the moment.
Well, there's an article today with Pascal Donahue, talking about infrastructure spend and easing up the conditions. Because he's moved in there, he's the Minister for Deeper, and he's looking, and we've only built 207 out of 1,263 infrastructure projects in the last 5 years. And he's saying, why is this not happening? He's copped on himself.
All right.
It is too bloody complicated.
All right, I want to bring in some of the others. Minnie, you picked a piece by Holly Cairns in the Sunday Mirror. What planet is the Taoiseach living on?
Yeah. Well, it was funny. The headline really struck me because I had pretty much asked myself the same question for, days in a row before I actually saw it. Because I've seen so many comments now that Leo Varadkar has made that just seems so out of touch. I mean, there was the one last year about young people moving to New York and Sydney. Well, they won't find better prices over there, whereas a lot of people have said they actually have found better prices over there.
In fairness, though, it is an international issue.
There is definitely.
Rents and
no, there definitely is. I think it's more to do with not necessarily that they'll find lower rents, but maybe just lower cost of living in general, or maybe a better job over there. It's sort of a combination of things. And then there was the comment of, oh, the eviction ban, it wasn't really stopping homelessness or something to that effect. And it, that again, that just struck me as a really out of touch thing to say, because while the homelessness numbers may not have been going down, they're going to only go up more now that the eviction ban has been lifted. So
yeah. I suppose, we don't know is the honest answer, Christina, isn't it? I mean, we've been given an Armageddon style scenario from the opposition, but we don't know is the answer what the outcome of this is going to be. Tsunami is the word used a lot by Ali Cairns, like, and people like that.
Just picking up there, like the comment by Leo Varadkar saying that the eviction ban didn't prevent homelessness from going up. Yes, the numbers went up even when we had the eviction ban. But I suppose the argument is, if we didn't have it in place, would have gone up a hell of a lot more.
A lot of those numbers went up because of family disputes.
I think there was
a big chunk of the new homeless during that period. I think there was a percentage on it, and it was very high.
People
who could no longer.
There's
live
a lot of unknowns, I think, even
so,
from the government side of this.
So, you know, evictions are not the only thing making people homeless.
Yeah, but there's big question marks, I think, even from the government perspective over their actions that they're taking with the eviction ban, on the reasons why people are getting notices to quit. Even when we're discussing why landlords are leaving the market, there's a whole quagmire, I think, of issues there that we still have question marks over. We've had, you know, the Taoiseach saying things like, you know, there's a big number of people that are returning home that can't move back into their apartment because it's being let out. Look, we don't know what the figure is of that. You know, we've asked the department what stats they have on that. There's a lot of unknowns, I think, here. I do feel over the last week, given the eviction ban being lifted, there is a level of nervousness within Leinster House at the moment. I've been in, you know, a studio like this countless times over the last number of years talking about the housing emergency, the housing crisis. Can it get worse? I do feel it goes through peaks and troughs of the pressure that's going on the government, but I feel this could be a big issue for them, given that, yes, the homeless numbers are most likely going to go up. I think even the housing minister has admitted that. The opposition, this is an easy win for them in terms of the next couple of months. You're going to see, you know, we've already seen it in the Dáil this week with Rona Murphy, Wexford TD, speaking about, you know, homeless people coming into the Dáil. You know, you're going to have those personal stories behind every single number of those figures as a person. Like with the Journal today, we've catalogued some of those people that are facing into the unknown, you know, at the end of the month. And then we have on the flip side, you have people like Niamh Horan today writing in the Sunday Independent, speaking to Irish estate and letting agents on the flip side of this. So I don't think there is a winner at all in any. I don't think the demonisation, as we say, of landlords is going to serve anyone at this point in time. You know, we need landlords in the game in order to provide the housing that we need. But I do feel that there is a real head scratching out there among the public of how the lack of urgency seemed to prevail up until the point where we were going to lift that eviction ban.
At the very least, it feels like the government has lost control of the narrative.
Well, the scrambling of those measures.
When you have
independence, I'm saying, being relied on for confidence motions and all the rest, you're in a very bad place.
Well, when you have also, I think as a lot of people have pointed out, the independents seem to be the ones who came up with the kind of mitigation measures that the government should have been thinking about 6 months ago. Ciarán, are we going to see a tsunami, do you think?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. And Nasa Harrigan, in her piece in the Sunday Independent today, even admits herself that she doesn't know whether or not there will be. So there are a lot of unknowns, as you say, but there are a lot of knowns. The number of commencements in February was three shy of 2,000. So 2,000 commencements in February. Annualise that, that's about 24,000 units been built this year, which is below the 30,000 last year, and which is way short. 24,000 commencements. So I believe the target in the Department of Housing is in and around 33,000. So we know that the target this year, we know in the middle of March that the target will be missed in December by 9,000 for this year, adding to the 250.
Assuming that February is an average month, assuming, like, there could be more starts.
But
in the
I think Tom will agree.
And I think 24 and 25 as well. There's a lot more questions over 24 and 25. Wouldn't there be, Brendan, Tom?
Yeah, I think we'll be struggling to meet last year's target, the 30,000 this year.
And it's so frustrating. I mean, the Taoiseach came out recently and said there's a shortage of 250,000 already. And it, like, the public is scratching their heads. This is a national emergency. We've had wheezes and plans since 2014. Harry McGee did a piece yesterday. Since 2014, when Housing Minister Alan Kelly announced a €3.8 billion plan to build 35,000 new houses. Subsequently, Simon Coveney came out with a plan, 47,000. Owen Murphy came out. We've had these plans for almost a decade now, and it's getting worse and worse. Now, a reasonable person would look at this and say, the amount of money we're putting in this, the amount of manpower, I believe there's new special advisors appointed to the minister and the junior minister for housing recently as well, the amount of resources we're putting into this, the homeless figures are increasing, the number required, the deficit in housing stock is increasing, and you're looking at this thinking, this is either gross incompetence or they actually do not want to solve this. I mean, what other reason could there possibly be? I mean, we need to look at this. For example, and the developers will tell you there's a problem with planning. There's on the books, there's statutory, there's legislation for in terms of infrastructure projects that are deemed to be of strategic national importance, that they go through a faster process. Why can't we apply that, for example, to housing, to speed it up? You know, there needs to be a task force, because we've so many commissions and land development agencies.
Yeah, but something that cuts through. Okay. Tom, of course, as a you're a former PD, and ye were a tail that people would say wagged the dog very successfully at one stage in government. You picked out Elaine Byrne's piece, "Cute Politics Continues as Independent Deputies Wield Their Own Official Power." We alluded to it there. The regional independents seem to have been the big winner, or the reasonable independents, as I believe they're called, seems to have been the big winners of the last week.
Yeah, and coming forward with some common sense stuff, as you said yourself, like, it wasn't rocket science. And Sean Kenny, and he's Kenny by name and Kenny by nature, he's a former QS and has a great understanding of construction and the issues and so on. And I hear him regularly raising issue. Construction is a very complicated game, there's no question about it. So, like, landlords are getting out, they've been vilified. I think it's been covered widely, you know, by the estate agencies that was referred to here.
Yeah, that new forum piece. Tax, red tape, rent pressure zone, social stigma, it makes no economic sense. They were the kinds of issues.
They've been taxed at 50%. If you're an institutional, international owner of a block of apartments, you get an entirely different rate of taxation. So, and that's never been addressed. And the Department of Finance down the years and at budgets, they've always said no. But it's interesting, Michael Lowry is getting a lot of credit from Elaine Byrne in her article there, because he's in the Dáil for, I think, 36 continuous years.
Backhanded credit, no, you'd have to say.
Well, I don't. She says that she's playing a blinder, and it wouldn't be something that she's admiring him, and that's something she doesn't come easy to her.
No.
But, like, he's been topping the poll in Tipperary over the years, and whoever comes after him, I'd say, if he's a Lowry, will continue to do that, because he delivers for his people, and he has come forward with sensible ideas. And it's probably the case, like, I think.
Yeah, he delivers for his people, but the job of the Dáil is to deliver for the whole country.
Yeah,
meaning you're listening to all this.
The government just have a majority of one at the moment.
Yeah,
so they're absolutely dependent on those independents to keep them in
their position. Yeah. Well, now you're listening to all this, Minnie Mooney. Mm-hmm. So, tell me about your own aspirations and that of your peers and stuff.
Yeah.
Does owning a house seem like a reality?
No.
Ever?
No, I mean, for my generation anyway, it's this whole kind of the lifting of the eviction ban and this whole kind of thing has been just a reminder to people who are my generation how unstable the housing market is and how genuinely scary the prospect of actually leaving your parents' house. Because I would say that, you know, a lot of people in my generation were worried about not being able to own a house, but at least at the moment we have kind of the luxury of still being able to live at home with parents, and we're not facing homelessness like a lot of people are. So I would say that. But yeah, it is just a reminder. Like for my generation, it's rent is scary because of everything to do with the eviction ban. Like I said, it's just been a reminder that that is unstable. And I don't know really anyone in my generation who has ever said confidently, I want to buy a house in Ireland and that's a viable prospect for me. That's what I'm going to do. And a lot of these people are from Dublin. Like they live, and a lot of the people I know are from, because where I live is in South Dublin, they would be from South Dublin. So even, and maybe they might have gone to a good school or got a job in college, any of that kind of stuff.
Would have been brought up to expect an affluent middle class lifestyle.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I hope I don't sound snobby when I say that. I'm not trying to at all. It's just exactly like you said, they would have grown up seeing what their parents had and kind of expecting that for themselves. And it's kind of like somebody pulled the rug out from underneath so everyone in my generation.
Middle class dream is, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot of people just look at emigrating instead. There's Australia is a huge thing for people in my generation.
Is that the default position now for a lot of people?
Yeah. A lot of people. And Canada is another big one, America. But they, it seems like they hit a particular age, kind of coming to the end of a college degree, maybe, or if you're not in college, it's around the same age, sort of 23, maybe. And yeah, just kind of look around and think, OK, what's next? OK, there's nothing here. I'm leaving because it's just, it seems safer.
OK, that's dark. All right, Christina Finn, Ciarán MacAvoird, Tom Parlin and Minnie Mooney staying with us. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Christina Finn, Ciarán MacAvoird, Tom Parlin and Minnie Mooney are still with us. Ciarán, as the most economist-y person here, Dan O'Brien gave a very chilling assessment of things last week where he basically said we could be looking at a systemic crisis and stuff. There does seem to be general kind of negativity around about the economy. You were looking at the front page of the Business Post there.
Yes, well, you're right. And central banks are stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, they're increasing interest rates in order to combat inflation. At the same time, they don't want to tip economies that are fragile enough already into recession. And to add to the woes, as you say, there's a piece on the front page of the Sunday Business Post about our shadow banking sector, which has almost doubled in 6 years. Shadow banking, of course, is regulated, it's outside, it's intermediated finance outside of the banking sector, so it's not regulated by the ECB or the Irish Central Bank, and
we're kind of a world leader in this kind of thing, aren't we, down at the IFSC?
We're a big player in this, which is famously called the Wild West of finance by the Wall Street Journal not so long ago. And I suppose I think the German government had to come in to bail out a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank way back in after the financial crisis. They weren't thanking us for that. But basically, shadow banking, it allows fund riskier assets more cheaply. And it's fine in times of cheap money. But when interest rate rises, you know, the old Warren Buffett, you know, we see who's swimming naked. So in times of rising interest rates, you know, there's a lack of supply maybe of good collateral. So
this is one to keep an eye on for sure.
Yes.
I saw a great quote, by the way, a guy called Benson Durham, head of global policy at Piper Sandler, but he's former Fed, right? He said they always wanted financial conditions to tighten, but in an orderly way. Having bank runs is a disorderly way. So what they wanted to happen is happening, but it's not happening the way they wanted it to happen. Listen, before we finish up, there's a couple of things I wanted to get to. Minnie,
yes.
Prince Harry and ayahuasca.
Yeah.
I'm curious about this because a lot of people, I'd say Ciarán MacAvoird is smiling over there, a lot of midlife crisis now involves people going off finding themselves with ayahuasca, which is a kind of a psychedelic from the Amazon or something,
yes,
isn't it? That will show you your soul, as if anyone wants to see their soul. But Prince Harry has seen his soul anyway with it, yeah.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
In the mail.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like a lot of people with Prince Harry at this point. I kind of just want him to shut up about a lot of things. But this particular article says that Harry astounded many by admitting he had used the drug and the royal also recommended it to others. And so the problem I have with it is a lot of people who are in the public eye, figures like Joe Rogan just popped into my head, for example, they would kind of talk about this and would admit to having used it. Various typically American comedians have said they do it, but they go to specific retreat centers to use it. That's what the article was also talking about, trying to organize these retreats in Ireland. And they're, you know, wellness retreats, and you go to a sauna and then you take this and your dosage is recommended to you based on your height and your weight, and you're supervised the entire time while you, like you said, look into your soul. And the problem I have with Prince Harry is that this article apparently anyway says he recommended it to other people. And I think there's a difference between saying, I've taken this, like figures like Joe Rogan do, I've taken this in my spare time, I've done this. Mm. And then someone saying, I've done this, it's brilliant, you should do it too. Particularly with someone like Prince Harry, because you don't know who's listening.
Yeah, and you don't know what's going on in other people's heads. Some people might be able for the old ayahuasca, and for other people then, like, they might never come back.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. And you have people then who will take, again, it's different from these centres where it's kind of, you're supposed to do it. You have people who don't know what amount to take or where to take it or when to take it. So if someone just says to you, I did it and it was great, and you think, I can do it and it'll be great, it doesn't matter where or when or how much, that's
I will
danger.
Admit, I'm nervous about us making any suggestion that if you are going to take ayahuasca, make sure it's a registered shaman gives it to you, right? We're not in any way encouraging anyone to take ayahuasca.
Good point.
But it is interesting what you say about people talking about it. I think there's a new version of the old joke. How do you know if someone's taken ayahuasca? Because they'll tell you. Okay. Kieran, there's another piece you picked there about, where is it, about the gym in Nidal.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a piece.
What
in
paper
the,
is that in?
In the Sunday Times, page 8, that politicians, whatever about their inaction on housing, they're very inactive in the Dáil gym. So the Dáil deputies have only used the Dáil gym, it's at their lowest ever level, one visit every 3 days.
You don't mean each of them is going every three days.
No.
You mean there's one TD spotted there every 3 days.
Going every 3 days, okay, to the Dáil gym.
But there are other people using it, I presume.
There are, yes, the Dáil staff use it. They make quite good use of it, but our TDs, no.
Maybe it's a good sign, Christina, that they have enough
that
to be
busy
doing without going to the gym. Tom, do you have lifetime access to the Dáil gym, having been a member of the Oireachtas?
I'm not sure, Brendan. That's an indication. I don't, right?
Did you ever darken the door even once every three days?
I don't even know where it is in there.
But
I'd say politicians currently are sort of getting their steps up by knocking on doors and thinking about the next election. It's only next year. So,
so they need to get on the treadmill. Yeah. Next year or sooner. Listen, before we go, we've about 1 minute. Who picked the Gen Z language terminology? Minnie.
That was me, yeah.
Yeah.
That made me laugh.
If I put a full stop in an email to you, would you see it as an act of aggression?
According to this piece, I would. I personally wouldn't. Because I am, maybe this is just me, but I am a little bit old school. I like very formal emails. You know,
no kisses at the end to people you don't know.
To people I don't know, no. I have to say no. Whereas I'm different now in my personal life. If I text my mom and she doesn't send me a smiley face, I think, oh my God, she hates me. Like, this is, it's
really
over.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
your poor snowflake.
Yeah. I'm. Yeah.
Mommy, you don't love me anymore.
I know. Oh
There's
my God,
no
it's terrible.
Face.
She pulls me up on it all the time. She's like, would you ever stop? Just grow up.
Okay, well, listen, you know what? She'll love you today now after you've been on the radio.
But it's funny, you know, it has, it's talking about the kind of generational gap. And there is a thing here, like the words slay, bop, the ick, it hits different, yas, queen, all this kind of stuff. I find it really, really cringy. And a lot of people in my generation do use it, but they use it ironically a lot of the time as well. It's not. But if you do hear the words, like, it's good to be up to date on them.
It's good, but I think about beyond a certain age, none of us should attempt to use those words. Okay. Christina Finn, Kira McInver, Tom Parlin and Minnie Mooney, thank you very much.